Representative Thatcher.
Mr. Chair, I move we reconsider the vote by which H.J.R. 7 was sent to the floor with a due pass.
Is there any discussion? Seeing none, clerk, please call the roll.
Gatto.
Excused.
Representative Farr.
Aye.
Representative Greenlee.
Aye.
Representative Hobie.
Aye.
Representative March.
Aye.
Representative Thatcher.
Aye.
Chair Kitt.
Chair votes aye. Motion passes. The vote has been reconsidered. And once Representative Lim gets back from his trip overseas, we will reconsider that vote.
Be an amendment to it.
Yes, it's my understanding at this time. At this time, colleagues, we will be opening a public hearing on H.C.R. 15. Committee Administrator, would please read the summary on H.C.R. 15.
Chair Kitt and Committee, H.C.R. 15 commemorates Mark O'Hatfield for his years of public service.
Thank you, Cletus. Colleagues, H.C.R. 15 comes to you with a myriad of sponsors, obviously not a partisan issue for the service that Governor slash Senator slash State Representative slash State Senator Mark Hatfield slash everything that's possible in public service, Mark Hatfield, for his years of service. Is there any discussion on H.C.R. 15?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Greenlee.
I would just like to put in the record, I've admired Senator Hatfield enormously as a statesman through time, and in the last 6 years I've got to know him and work personally with him as he served as chair of the board of the Northwest Health Foundation. He's one of the extraordinary individuals, and I think a real hero to those of us who believe that politics ought to be nonpartisan and that ought to be active as statespeople. I'm just delighted to have this resolution in our committee and on the floor.
I will echo those sentiments. I will just enter into the record. I worked for a congressman back in Washington, D.C. by the name of Joe Scarborough, who was swept into office in the Republican takeover of 1994 and was not one of the moderates or those that you would consider the bipartisan of in nature. And I recall in reading the former Congressman Scarborough's book that just came out, where his biggest, what he had said about the members of Congress is they owed Mark Hatfield the biggest apology for being the deciding vote when these fire-breathing people back in Washington, D.C. wanted him stripped of his chairmanship of the Appropriations Committee when he voted against the balanced budget amendment and was the deciding vote and killed that. And Joe Scarborough says the Republicans in Congress now owe him the biggest apology ever for their spending like pigs, and there's no way they could have adhered to their own legislation. So I think that the kudos and the respect for Senator Hatfield go far beyond a moderates, a liberals, conservatives. It goes to a statesman, and I think that you've hit the nail on the head, and I hope one day that this body can get back to that process. So, any further discussion on H.C.R. 15? Seeing none, I will close the public hearing on H.C.R. 15 and open a work session on H.C.R. 15.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Thatcher.
I move House Concurrent Resolution 15 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Thatcher moves House Concurrent Resolution 15 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Seeing none. Clerk?
Representative Gatto.
Excused.
Representative Farr.
Aye.
Representative Greenlee.
Aye.
Representative Holby.
Aye.
Representative March.
Aye.
Representative Thatcher.
Aye.
And Chair Kitt.
Chair votes aye. HCR, receiving the adequate number of affirmative votes, is declared passed. A carrier of the bill, we will assign Representative slash Speaker Minnis to carry this bill. Moving right along, we'll now open a public hearing on H.J.R. 1. If the administrator would read the bill summary on H.J.R. 1.
Chair Kitson, Committee, H.J.R. 1, amends Oregon Constitution require annual sessions. Odd years not exceed 120 calendar days, even years not exceed 60 calendar days.
Thank you, Cletus. H.J.R. 1 obviously invokes a constitutional amendment to require annual sessions, which the legislature in Oregon has never done. This would be a big change, but maybe a needed one. So let's have some discussion on it. This time I'll call forward Kate Culberson. Culberson, you can correct me when you get down here.
You all need to pull in here.
Representative Kitson, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to testify. I'm Kate Culbertson. I'm from the League of Women Voters of Ashland. I live at 2355 Lupine in Ashland. The League is a grassroots, nonpartisan political organization which encourages the informed and active participation of citizens in government. The League of Women Voters of Oregon has already turned in testimony in support of this bill, but I'm here to endorse the testimony and ask you to move H.J.R. 1 forward after careful and serious discussion. Annual sessions will afford greater opportunities for citizen involvement. Among other considerations, the League believes the legislature should be permitted to meet in annual session, which is a decision reached by our members after research and discussion, and one that we have supported for more than 20 years. H.J.R. 1 amends the Oregon Constitution to provide greater citizen involvement. Annual sessions will afford greater opportunities for citizen involvement. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much for your testimony here today. Colleagues, this is a topic that we have kicked around a bit, and I think that this particular topic is starting to gain some momentum. I think in light of the last few sessions, the tension, the special sessions, the length of the current session, not this current session, but last current session, without special sessions, was the longest in Oregon's history, and this is a valid discussion. I would actually like to hear from our two guest representatives who have not had, the extensive vetting out of this particular H.J.R. 1, because I haven't been a regular member of this committee, but I off the cuff, if it's not too putting you on the spot, which I do not want to do, but I'd love to hear your thoughts on this, as you are members of the legislative body. So why don't we start with Representative Buckley, and then we'll go to Representative Esquivel for just a few minutes of discussion on this.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Similar to the statement by the League of Women Voters, I would back this proposal with the hope that it would encourage greater participation on a regular basis from citizens of our state. It's fascinating to come from here and go to Salem. It seems like a different world to get up there and to kind of lose the ability to interact with people and then go back to from here and go back to Salem and have an impact. I think there's a legitimate attempt to address the kind of disconnect that people feel from the state government.
I think that you hit several of the nails that we've discussed right on the head here. If you look at the 120-day one year and then the 60-day the next year, if you add that up, it's 6 months, which is roughly what it looks like we're going to be in session this time, provided things continue along the same track that they are now. Although we all know how that could go. It could very easily go from June and Kumbaya to December, and we're not going to take it. So it would, in my estimation, if members of this body knew constitutionally, you have 120 days to get your business done. You get a lot less dragging of the feet, a lot less loggerheads and partisan gridlock, because there's, quite frankly, no you've got a finite amount of days. You best put your differences aside and work out an agreement. So, for those reasons, we were even discussing this bill. Representative Esquivel, your thoughts?
Well, I think that any way that we can initiate and try to set an environment for compromise, that behooves us to do so. If you're up against a timeline, you're more apt to compromise in any venue. A good compromise, like our Representative Buckley and I, our senator in this region, Senator Bates, says, the best compromise is something that no one likes. And I think that's very true, because everyone gives and takes. I think that this has some very good possibilities, because it puts you in a time frame, and you have 3 months or 4 months, and then you have the remainder of the time in the off year. So I think this has some very, very good potential. But more importantly, I think it'll bring us to the point of where we'll start working together more amicably. And we've all seen where sometimes being in the building too long is not detrimental to relationships, and I think that this has some very good possibilities.
Thank you, Representative. I appreciate your insight. I'm wondering if the committee would be open to this. Just came to mind, because it's such a big bill and affects so many people in the legislative process, if maybe before we decide to go to a work session on this, that we have a public hearing on it later on in the evening to allow our colleagues to come forward and testify, saying what this would mean to them. I mean, I've got to believe that unless you want rich people, retired people, or people whose spouse will support their political habit, you've got to define what the legislative assembly means. I'm speaking from my perspective. So if, in fact, I'm maintaining a job, I can say to my employer, I'm going to be gone for X amount of days, and I will be back, knowing the following year I'm going to be gone for X amount of days, I will be back, as opposed to, I'm going to go down there and serve, see on the flip side, you know, and just be understanding. And I think that it would be more conducive to bring a wide array of people into the process and not becoming the most exclusionary, elitist club in the state of Oregon, which is ultimately what you're getting. The longer your sessions go, you X out so many people that would like to serve but just can't financially or with small children do such. Representative Greenlee.
Mr. Chair, I think that would be a great idea, but it would also be useful to me in that kind of a hearing if we had whoever are the experts in how this might actually work. For example, it would seem to me it would be very, very useful if when you start in the odd year with a four-month session, if the regular committee stayed through until until the even number session. There are all sorts of details about how this might work, and it would be really interesting. I don't know whether it's legislative administrative or legislative council or who it is that would explain to us how this might actually be in operation relative to that and a variety of other dimensions. I think it would be very good for the public debate to have some of that discussion.
Well, I think the other component that Representative Marks would write next, the other component to what you're saying, Representative Greenlee, is if in fact you had something dovetail along with this to say, each committee shall meet once a month, so that you don't have this hiatus of 18 months, come back in, try to punch everything out. You know, I mean, you're just getting acclimated to the process after about 60 days, where you're settling in, understanding. Especially if you're a freshman, you've not been in the process, and that's no slight. We've all been freshmen. That's no slight to those that are freshmen. It's the reality.
I was thinking what we might have along with this would be a bill that would deal with a variety of details. You don't need to put those into the Constitution, but it might be good to have a companion bill that, if this is endorsed by the people, here's how things would work. So the debate of the people, we could say to them, well, here's what it means in terms of the details.
I think that's a great idea. Representative March.
Yes, thank you. I think the concept certainly has some merit. I would open up the way this is envisioned in writing, the odd-numbered year, the four-month session, only budget. And I think I would open that up for, to some extent, for regular legislation. And if you wanted to put some sidebars on that, you know, you could have limited number of bills or something. But without the ongoing committees, definitely you'd want to have the ability to run some legislation around during the budget year.
And I think that you bring up a very, very valid point. And I think that also if the committees were required to meet but once a month and start working legislation during that time, that coming to the point of opening up for legislative concepts, you had 18 months, essentially, you know, in this case it wouldn't be quite 18 months, 14, to say, okay, we had 14 months of deliberation on this, as opposed to, hey, I've got a great idea, let me convince my, you know, 31 on one and 16 in the center office that this is a great idea in 6 months, and shoving it through. I think you would have less legislation through the process because you'd have more time to vet it out. Great. Any other discussion on HJR 1? Representative Farr.
Mr. Chair, thank you. I appreciate your comments, and I do think that you might have less legislation, but I think also the important point to make is that you would probably have better legislation. You'd have much more time for discussion, and I like your idea of committees meeting once a month. I also think that along with that, work groups need to be established that are working on specific issues, and those work groups can meet more often. You know, a lot of what we do in the legislature is we undo bad legislation, and so let's start to to work on good policy. And I think that you brought up a good way to do that.
Well, thank you, Representative. I think this is a discussion that's going to go forward and hopefully get some merit. Representative Greenlee.
You know, if we are going to seriously consider this one, you might think about forming a work group to talk about some of the details and perhaps to talk about a companion bill with it. It might be a way to move it.
I think that's a great idea. Cletus, if you could note that, I think by the end of next week we will establish a work group, and I would ask of the committee and the committee guests that if there is anybody in particular that you would like to be a part of this work group, that you submit that to Cletus. It's going to be a big work group, but I think that we need all factions of, I think labor needs to be there, I think business needs to be there, I think the league needs to be there, and various groups, and put some solid walls around. I think it's a great idea, but I would also say that if you're going to go down this path, it's going to have to, I mean, it's going to incur a lot of different things, such as the things that the efficiencies of raising legislators' salaries, because the time commitment is now going to be year-round and annually raising the allotment for staff that we have, because you're going to be required to have staff year-round. But I think those are good things for the people and for us to get off poverty. So with that, any further discussion? Seeing none, I'll close the public hearing on HJR 1. I'm looking for that. That's funny. Donna. Representative Nelson, whom is the chairman of the Veterans Affairs Committee, has vowed to find me a wife by the end of session so that I can fit into that third criteria that I mentioned. So, it's an inside joke that you are now privy to, as is the entire public record. True. And they're going to volunteer to co-chair that. They don't realize what they would be getting someone into, I assure you. With that, colleagues, before I get any more embarrassed, we will move on to House Bill 2583. Open a public hearing on House Bill 2583. Cletus, if you could read the bill summary on House Bill 2583.
Mr. Chair and Committee, HB 2583 requires evidence of citizenship for individuals registering to vote for the first time in Oregon. Declares an emergency to be effective on passage.
Thank you, Cletus. At this time, I will call forward Kathy Beckett, who will be testifying in opposition to House Bill 2583.
Good morning.
Good morning,
Chair Kitts and committee members. My name is Kathy Beckett. I live at 1535 Stardust Way, Medford. I am the county clerk in Jackson County, and I am in my sixth term.
Congratulations.
Thank you. I come before you today to speak in opposition of HB 2583. This bill, as currently proposed, I believe would place an undue burden on many of the citizens of Oregon. As this committee is already well aware, there is already a 20-day voter registration cutoff for new voters. To require citizens or persons to show copies of their birth certificate, naturalization document, or United States passports would not only be expensive, but would require an amount of time that it takes to receive these documents that could delay registration long after deadline for an election. I believe our college-age students could be penalized to a higher degree than most the rest of our population, further exacerbating the already low voter turnout of our youth. Under current law, when a voter fills out a registration card, a precinct memorandum card is sent to the voter at the address stated on the registration card. If the person is not at the address, the memorandum card is sent back to the elections office and the registration is placed in an inactive file. And if no activity occurs, the person is deleted after 5 years. The implementation of the statewide voter registration system should assist in cleaning up folks who move from county to county. As our office was working through the November 2nd, 2004 general election, we received approximately 300 registration cards that we were not able, because of addresses, we could not put them in our address library. Thus, these persons were not registered. I believe much of this activity was brought about due to various registration activities where persons were being paid to register voters. I would suggest that under the Help America Vote Act, HAVA, that there is already federal law in place to deal with first-time registrations. First-time registrants by mail only can produce a valid photo identification such as a driver's license, a paycheck stub, a utility bill, a bank statement, or a government document. If a first-time registrant mails in their voter registration card without identification, we are required to notify them immediately that we need copies of their identification. If we still do not receive their identification, we are then required to send a second notice. During the general election, approximately 85% of Jackson County residents who are at the legal age of registration are registered to vote in Jackson County. I thank you, Chair Kitts, and the committee members for allowing me to speak, and I entertain any questions that you might have. And after yesterday's session, I'm sure you have a number of them.
Yeah, Kathy, I have just a couple questions that seem to be standard now. Currently, how many voters on file do you have that have registered to vote but not submitted documentation that's required?
Currently, we have probably close to 1,000 or more. And we have our registration is about 80,000 registered voters in Jackson County. 80,000.
80. Mm-hmm. That'll do it for me right now, Representative Mark.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You mentioned that some voter registration drives were paying for signatures. Did you have any reports of people paying like a special bounty for registering one party or the other?
Right. We had a registration drive here locally just outside of our main DMV office here in Medford that was paying like a buck for each registration that they... First-time registrants by mail only can produce a valid photo identification, such as a driver's license, a paycheck stub, a utility bill, a bank statement, or a government document. If a first-time registrant mails in their voter registration card without identification, we are required to notify them immediately that we need copies of their identification. If we still do not receive their identification, we are then required to send a second notice. During the general election, approximately 85% of Jackson County residents who are at the legal age of registration are registered to vote in Jackson County. I thank you, Chair Kitts, and the committee members for allowing me to speak, and I entertain any questions that you might have. And after yesterday's session, I'm sure you have a number of them.
Yeah, Kathy, I have just a couple questions that seem to be standard now. Currently, how many voters on file do you have that have registered to vote but not submitted documentation that's required?
Currently, we have probably close to 1,000 or more. And we have, our registration is about 80,000 registered voters in Jackson County. 80,000.
80. Mm-hmm. That'll do it for me right now. Representative Mark.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You mentioned that some voter registration drives were paying for signatures. Did you have any reports of people paying like a special bounty for registering one party or the other?
Right. We had a registration drive here locally just outside of our main DMV office here in Medford that was paying like a buck for each registration that they received for Republican registration cards. And it was noted at one point in time, or that it was assumed or alleged. It was alleged at one time that if they weren't registering Republican, they were tearing up any other registrations that they might receive because they were only getting paid for the Republicans. And after a period of time, we found that ceased. I mean, if it happened in the beginning, it ceased to keep on happening. It was taken care of immediately, and folks who had been registering that were concerned that their registrations might have been torn up then came into our office and re-registered again, and many of them were duplications, so we knew that it had been taken care of. I have a real problem with paying for any kind of signature gathering. I think it's a huge injustice to the system. But that's just my personal.
Thank you.
Appreciate your personal thing. Representative
Patrick,
question.
Yes, I do. You mentioned that there are about 1,000 voters who had not yet provided the required HAVA signature verification.
For the record, and for the people that are here, do you want to?
I shall read what that
what,
is.
What are the HAVA?
The Help America Vote Act says sufficient identification consists of a copy of a valid photo identification, such as a driver's license, a paycheck stub, a utility bill, a bank statement, a government document. Now, if they didn't submit that to you and they voted anyway, how many of them actually voted and still had their vote counted?
If they voted, all their votes counted. Under current law, they all count.
And if they vote in the federal election, then
yes.
That applies,
yes.
Also.
Let me explain that if the HAVA Act covers federal elections, and so if you registered to vote now, you would receive ballots for all of the elections. If you did not send in your identification, you would get your ballots. They would go on through the year. By the next federal election, we would send a ballot. If you did not return your identification, we would count the ballot anyway.
Follow up. Do you find that meaningful to have a Help America Vote Act requirement for certain types of identification, and even if they don't provide it, it doesn't seem to matter?
It's very labor intensive, and It puts us through hoops that we're required to do by law, but when it comes down to it, it really doesn't have any bearing in the end.
I'm sorry?
I say we ought to vote to change federal law.
One day.
You wish.
The thought process that I was running through my mind just went right out the gutter.
I guess, you know, one comment that I'd like to make here is that, you know, number one, do we have a problem out there with non-citizens registering to vote? And I don't know if anyone on this committee has the answer to that, but I know that in my office, we have never had a problem with that. My concern is that if, you know, our goal here is to get people registered and have them active in the political process. And it seems like we further keep putting into place deterrence from allowing that to happen. And I get real concerned that we could put into law that would further exacerbate the problem and make it more difficult for citizens to register and vote. And there may not be a real problem out there. And so are we over-legislating ourselves? I'm concerned about that.
Kathy, I would disagree with you on that point. From the perspective, I think Oregon is probably one of the easiest states to get registered to vote, with 70-plus percent of those that are eligible to vote registered to vote. And of that 70-plus percent that are registered to vote, 80-plus percent participate. We mail these people ballots at public expense just for registering, whether or not they've shown, unless they've missed, you know, for 5 years or two, I believe it's two consecutive elections, unless that's county by county to determine that. So I would take issue with that statement. The second part of that is I would also take issue with those, and I agree with you, there may not be a case of fraudulent activity in your county that you can cite. I would be willing to bet that those counties in Washington State that were allowing felons to vote and people to vote twice probably would have stood here before, had the roles been reversed, and Oregon were in the same situation as Washington's in now, and Washington were taking up these discussions, they probably would testify to the same effect. Well, we don't have that sort of thing here, X, Y, and Z, because it hadn't happened. But I think in the case of Washington State, when you're seeing a governor's race decided by just over 100 votes, and they've got 94 confirmed felons that voted. The felons? We've been on the road too long to get there. But these are the issues, and I don't think the committee has the intention of pointing fingers or saying you're doing something wrong, because quite frankly, I think the county clerks in the state, in my experience has been, work their tail off to do a very good job and are following the law to the letter of the law. But whether or not that is enough to potentially protect from something that may or may not be right or wrong is more the intent. So,
Chair Kitts, if I could just interject here, actually, voter registration law is the same in every state. We all have motor voter under NAVRA. That was put into place many years ago, and so we all have the same voter registration laws.
But we all don't have vote by mail.
No, we don't.
Representative Greenwood.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd like to take you down a little bit down another path. And my question may be negated by where we're going with the centralized registration system in the state, which will come online pretty soon. But I've been worried about a different issue in the past, when most of us who've knocked on as many doors as we've knocked on with a voter registration list in our hand may know the voter registration list better than you know it, in a sense. And one thing that I would find periodically would be a household that would have William J. Jones and W. James Jones listed with the same birthday listed in the House, and I would find that occasion, I would, when I found it, sometimes call the clerk's office. But if that happened and they're both on the list, do they both get ballots? And if ballots come in from both of those folks, W. James Jones and William J. Jones, for the same birthday, would both of those votes count?
Chair Kiss and Representative Greenwood, and what we do is we go through our voter registration list and look for those types of things. When we find a matched birth date like that with the names that are very similar, we contact and attempt to clean those issues up. And hopefully when you receive printouts from our offices and you see that happening on your list, we want you to bring that to our attention so that we can get on top of it. Obviously, if those were not caught, then two ballots would go out. And if I suppose a person could receive two ballots, and as long as their signature matched up with their voter registration card, potentially they could both count. We really, really watch for that kind of thing, because matched birth dates sends a real signal to us.
But as Representative Greenwich said, once the centralized voter system's in place, that particular situation...
But those types of things should not be happening now either.
Well, they could be twins. There are some conceivable reasons why it could happen. But
the reality is, if that were to happen, once the centralized voter system's in place, that scenario would be virtually impossible to encounter.
We will hope so. We hope that we're tightening up this system just as tight as we can make it.
And if they voted, if a person voted that way and voted two ballots, that would be a felony, wouldn't it?
It certainly would.
Thank you. Representative Thatcher, did you have a question for me?
I do, but it's already been answered.
Thank you. Representative Thatcher.
Thank you. I was also going to go a little bit different direction, too, because we've been talking about in past discussions how military ballots, if they've been received after the postmark, they didn't want to accept the postmark if it had been before the election because sometimes they couldn't read it. Now, apparently since signing under risk of committing a Class C felony, if you're a citizen, and you know, affirming the truth that you are a qualified voter, would you be open to allowing people who vote overseas, whose ballots may not make it here in time, but did vote before the election, to sign under the same type of affirmation to have their ballots counted?
Representative Kitts, Vice Chair Thatcher. In current Oregon laws, you're well aware, ballots must be received no later than 8 p.m. on election day in order to be counted. That includes military. If this body determines that they would like to see a change in that, that's up to you. I mean, obviously... We've got a number of different things going on in different states. I mean, Florida accepts military ballots, say, 10 days after the election. The state of Washington, I believe, gives a grace period of so many days after the election. You would just have to realize that it would take clerks that much longer after the process to certify the election. And so, I'm in favor of giving the military any break we can possibly give them. But we also feel that we send our ballots out in plenty of time for our voters to be able to return them on time. And yes, we do go that extra mile to assist them by allowing them to fax their selections back to us. We will fax the ballot to them. We've done overnight mails with the military. We have not... In Jackson County, I can only speak for Jackson County, we have not seen a huge amount of military ballots coming back to us after the election. We always get a few back, but there's not a huge majority of our military ballots. Our military know that they have to have them back to us by 8 p.m. election day, and they do everything in their power to get it to us. So it's just a philosophical, I mean, do we want to extend it 7 days after the election? I think it's a bigger question than I can answer.
Well, just, you said there weren't a whole lot returned after the election, so it probably wouldn't affect the certification of the election too much, but it just seems like every vote should count. And if they did vote beforehand, right now, that is current law, that if it doesn't get there on time, and that's outside of their control sometimes, then it doesn't count. And so if you had that affirmation statement, maybe perhaps that would be something you're open to. And I was just looking at you for your opinion, because you say we can change that, but that's why we're here discussing that. I'm wondering what your thoughts on that.
Representative Kitts, Vice Chair Thatcher, you know, I think that, you know, if you extend the day later than Election Day, why would you just extend it for the military and not extend it for other voters as well? And then you get into this realm of how long do you wait after the election? You're always going to have a few ballots that are going to come in after Election Day. I have people in this county that mail their ballots on Election Day. And I know that they have to get them to me by 8 p.m. And I make a special trip to the distribution center here at the post office to go down and try to retrieve as many of those ballots as I possibly can before the next morning. And I know many of the other counties do the same thing, because we're going that extra mile to try to assist the voters in their right of franchise. And I... You know, like I say, this is a huge question. And
Kathy, I think the specific reference to the military voters, especially in Florida, for the extension that they have, is not just for military voters. You can't just be on base, Eglin Air Force Base or Hurlburt or Pensacola NAS. It has to be an APL box, which basically is for those military men and women that are out at sea, that are not mailing it, put into a big bag and bundled up and thrown on the helicopter. Those are the ones that they're allowing for the extra. It's not just simply check the box, I'm a military voter, I get it in when I want. So I think we just need to be clear on that. Representative Holby.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was curious, do counties keep track of the numbers of ballots that they send overseas and to also keep track of the number of ballots they send to the military overseas?
Chair Kitts and Representative Colby, yes, we do. We keep infinite records on everything. We know exactly how many ballots are in the mail. We know how many ballots we've sent to our military overseas. And then, of course, we track them again when they come back in. And it's a process of, you know, how many have we received in the mail versus how many go through the signature verification process to the processing process and then to the vote count. We keep a log of those ballots all the way through the system up until we certify the election so that we know, you know, how many ballots we've processed and how many have been counted.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I assume you probably also keep track of the different countries as well that are ballots are mailed to, so the clerks could probably get some sort of idea that certain countries have more of a problem getting ballots back on time than others.
Representative Chair Kitts and Representative Holby, yes, that's true. We could tell you how many we send, you know, to Iran, Iraq. I mean, we know that, and if this is information that this committee needs at some point in time, I'm sure that we're able to provide you with that information.
Thank you.
Kathy, thank you for your testimony today.
Just a
final question.
Yeah. Do you have an idea of what the return rate was on the military ballot?
Right offhand, I'm sorry. Chair Kitts, Representative Greenlake. Right offhand, I really couldn't tell you. I know it's high, but I don't. I mean,
that'd be an interesting number.
We
to
could
guess.
Provide that information for Representative Greenlake.
Would you like it from all the counties?
I think Annette would probably be able to get that for us if that's the case. Are you concerned about this specific county?
No, I wasn't about this kind. I was just curious whether there is a specific problem in terms of military ballots getting back.
Please, if you could make a note to have Annette Newham provide for the committee the number of overseas ballots mailed, the number of overseas ballots returned.
Military ballots.
Do you want them by country? Kathy, thank you for your testimony here today.
Thank you very much.
At this time, we'll call forward Lynn Horstmeyer. I hope I said that right or got it close. If I didn't. Welcome, and please state your name for the record.
My name is Lynn Horstmeyer, and I live in Ashland, Oregon. And I am for the House Bill 2583. Many years ago, when I was 21, and back then you had to be 21 to vote, I had to show proof of citizenship and proof of my, you know, that I was 21 years old, so I had to have my birth certificate. And since I was married, I had to have my marriage license also because of the name change. So I have been voting for many years, and that's fine. Well, when I moved up to Oregon about 9 years ago...
Can you tell us for the record what state you moved from?
I moved from California.
Okay.
I moved up here from California about 9 years ago, and I got my driver's license, and I had to show, you know, ID, that's a photo ID. I had my California driver's license, and I had my passport. And then I had my, I had opened a checking account because I was moving here, and I had the, so I did have some ID that had my address on it. That is what I showed. Okay. However, my name, as you have here, is Lynn. That is the name that is on my Social Security card. My actual legal name is not Lynn. My California driver's license and my U.S. passport have my legal name on it. They issued me a driver's license. And by the way, I voted under my legal name in California. And that because it was the name I had. They issued me my driver's license and my voter registration under the same name my Social Security card has, which is Lynn. So, in Oregon, I am, I guess, legally Lynn.
Legal Lynn.
I'm a legal Lynn. But I think that can be a problem. I could actually go in, probably, and register under my legal name, and nobody would know the difference that there was two people, the same person. That's a problem. I really feel that anybody that registers to vote should have proof of citizenship the first time they register to vote. So I am very much for that. The other thing is that I recently picked up a pamphlet on the motor from the Department of Motor and Vehicles, and that pamphlet says the things that you can do, you can register to vote. Amongst the things it doesn't say is that you have to be a citizen to vote. They do not ask for any ID or proof of citizenship. It's very, very so lax. I mean, I've worked at headquarters, and I know that there's all you can't ask a person anything. You can't ask them whether they're here legally or illegally or okay. There are several different types of people. There are the illegal aliens, there are resident aliens, and there are people who are here on visa. And then there are U.S. citizens, born and naturalized. Now, U.S. citizens are the only ones who are allowed to vote, supposedly. But the way we register people to vote in this state anybody can register. And maybe it says, you know, under penalty of perjury, and you know anyone who has ever been cited or anybody who's ever been fined, gone to jail, or anything like that for lying about their voting in an election when they were not legally able to. I have a question also about the, if there are laws for the federal laws to say that, I don't know what the federal law is on felons being able to vote. Is that a federal law or just a state by state? Okay. Because that's, I would say, if there are certain laws that are federal that we aren't adhering to, it, then we would have a problem with the, you know, not being in, when one ballot goes out with federal and state things on it. So I want to be sure that the state is with the federal in anything that they require. So I think there was a question you asked me that on the rules of what they're supposed to do. And I just think that they aren't doing it that way because it's too hard. If we are not meeting the federal requirements, then we have a problem.
Thank you, ma'am. Are there any questions?
I just
Representative Greenlee, do you have a question?
Comment at this point. The issue we've raised is not that they're not meeting the federal requirements, but some people here are concerned that the federal requirements aren't strict enough.
Why? But I mean, we are. If I just have a concern that we can end up in the same situation that we have a lot of people voting here, do not, that are not. I mean, I think everybody should vote that is eligible to vote. And that doesn't mean I went out and registered.
Thank you, then. At this time, we'll call forward Clifton McMillan. Welcome.
Thank you. I'm happy to be here. It takes a little extra effort, but I think...
Is that seat going to be a problem for you?
Not until it's time to get up.
All right. Please state your name for the record,
My name is Clifton Hawkins McMillan III, and I am a resident of Klamath County at 1444 Pacific Terrace. And I was moved to make the journey... because I think this is one of the most critical issues that faces the state and the nation down there. They're having legislative hearings in Klamath Falls this morning, and I had to choose between Ways and Means and this. And I think
there's a boring.
Both problems, because this is certainly the critical issue as far as I'm concerned. Citizenship bears responsibilities. And those don't necessarily need to come cheap. If it takes a little effort to comply in the electoral process to substantiate the fact that you are qualified by the reason of citizenship, that's not too much to ask of Americans. It's a very small price to pay. When you look at the situation that exists with mass influx of migrants that started probably as a controlled mechanism with the Bracero program in the 50s and 60s for agricultural labor, that has expanded now into a horde of illegal residents in the country. Oregon, I think, is about 14th as a per capita percentage of illegal aliens residing in the state. California, of course, is much, much greater. And I think we're seeing this migration come north. We've educated these children in our schools. They're now speaking the language and participating in society, but still may not be citizens. There needs to be a way to address that, and I'm sure the United States Congress is going to get around to it sooner or later, and hopefully they'll do it in a responsible way. But as far as Oregon is concerned, in establishing citizenship, from my point of view, our system is way too loose. And by way of emphasizing the possible implications of that laxity, after the excessive drive to register voters in the last election, that were picking anybody up off any street corner or any place they could find somebody to turn in a certificate of registration, there emerged a group behind the scenes in the country who were prepared to challenge the results of the election based on the fact that the federal constitution requires citizenship to vote in federal elections, that is, for the presidency and for members of the Congress. Any state, presumably under states' rights doctrine, could decide a state policy that on election day anybody who was there and wanted to walk out could vote. And that wouldn't have grave national implications. But the idea that those, I think there are about 9 or 10 states that do not require proof of citizenship in order to register to vote, that could have thrown the election. New York State's one, Florida's one, Oregon's another. And if it had come down to a very close context, then this mechanism of challenge was waiting in the wings to happen. If that happened, the Constitution. That started probably as a controlled mechanism with the Bracero program in the 50s and 60s for agricultural labor that has expanded now into a horde of illegal residents in the country. Oregon, I think, is about 14th as a per capita percentage of illegal aliens residing in the state. California, of course, is much, much greater. And I think we're seeing this migration come north. We've educated these children in our schools. They're now speaking the language and participating in society, but still may not be citizens. There needs to be a way to address that, and I'm sure the United States Congress is going to get around to it sooner or later, and hopefully they'll do it in a responsible way. But as far as Oregon is concerned, and establishing citizenship, from my point of view, our system is way too loose. And by way of emphasizing the possible implication of that laxity, after the excessive drives to register voters in the last election that were picking anybody up off any street corner or any place they could find somebody to turn in a certificate of registration, there emerged a group behind the scenes in the country who were prepared to challenge the results of the election based on the fact that the federal constitution requires citizenship to vote in federal elections, that is, for the presidency and for members of the Congress. Any state, presumably under states' rights doctrine, could decide a state policy that on election day anybody who was there and wanted to walk up could vote. And that wouldn't have grave national implications. But the idea that those, I think there are about 9 or 10 states that do not require proof of citizenship in order to register to vote, that could have thrown the election. New York State's one, Florida's one, Oregon's another. And if it had come down to a very close context, then this mechanism of challenge was waiting in the wings to happen. If that happened, the constitutional challenge would have been to disqualify the votes in the federal offices in the states that did not require citizenship as a member, as a prerequisite to registering to vote. Now that bears implications of a constitutional crisis on a national scale that I don't think Oregon's system should contribute to the possibility of lending itself to. It's not a big thing. I'm sorry this legislation doesn't have something of a remedial component in it to go back to address people currently registered who may have not followed the rules in so doing. I understand the complexity of that. It's difficult enough for the county clerks to pick up from here and go forward, but I don't think it should be an impossible burden for them to do that. And I am tremendously supportive of this proposal and this legislation. Now, having said that, and having listened to the discussion expand a little more broadly, and you being the election subcommittee, is that true?
For the full committee.
Okay, the full committee. I have some other thoughts on elections I'd like to share with you, if that's not asking too much. I have been worried about the integrity of the process, particularly since the advent of mail-out ballots, mail-in ballots. I've been registered in this state for 47 years, and over that period of time, I certainly know my signature has changed, though my voter registration card has not. And I feel that there should be a biometric identifier that accompanies and certifies a ballot. And, of course, the easiest thing to do is the thumbprint. And in the ballot pack, there could be a small dry ink envelope with which you use. Because today, the process is so subjective. My 45-year-old signature is taken from my original registration card. It's scanned onto a computer screen, and often a volunteer election worker who may or may not Seawell is visually comparing my signature of certification on the security envelope with that which appears on the screen. Tremendously subjective process. All of you have campaigned. I'm sure you've been out beating the bush door to door, and you compare the voter registration rolls and the addresses thereon with the people that you encounter as you poll your districts and canvas, and it's alarming what a large percent of the people don't live where they're supposed to live. And without, you know, some positive identifier, I think the whole process is subject to manipulation from that point of view.
Listen, I'll tell you that if in fact the signatures don't match or they're deemed not to match, the county clerks do call and make every effort to get in touch with the folks. They're not just discarded ballots. Yeah, it doesn't match. It's not like that. It's a very labor-intensive process.
It does work the other way, because I've been witness in the county clerk's office and stood behind often very elderly people who volunteer to perform these services for the clerk. And more often, it's the other way around. Yes, it's close enough, and it goes in the good basket.
I got you. Great. Well, I appreciate you making the trek all the way.
I wouldn't miss it. And I'd also like to wind up saying how positive I think it is, the effort of the legislature to hold these hearings around the state. It's a big enough effort from Plymouth to Medford, but that's a whole lot easier than Plymouth to Salem.
Well, I will tell you that this committee, and this I say this every committee meeting, and I genuinely mean it from the bottom of my heart, this committee has been the most active committee in the legislature. We have made more stops statewide, much to the chagrin of some folks, but we have made our effort. We've gone to Central Oregon, Southern Oregon, the coast, the metro area, Eastern Oregon, trying to get a sense of what people think out there and trying to take this process to the people, because this process, speaking of elections, is the most fundamental right that Oregonians/Americans have, and we want to make sure that we do protect it and fix anything that may or may not be wrong with the system. So appreciate people like you coming all the way up here, and I think you made the better choice between us and Ways and Means, I got to tell you. Representative March made the same choice, so he's on both committees.
I hope your job is more doable in the short term.
Sure, appreciate it. Are there any questions? Seeing none, thank you.
Thank you.
This time.
Can I call my lawyer? Thank you, appreciate it.
Sure.
Yes.
Are we done with witnesses in this?
I'm sorry?
Are we done with witnesses in this?
No.
I'd like to make a brief statement before we close the hearing.
Yeah, but I call the last witness and then...
Okay.
That looks like a V. Vanya Sloan. Pretty name. I've never seen that before.
Thank you.
Good morning.
Ma'am? Excuse me. Push the mic away from me, please.
Away?
Is
that good? Okay.
Yeah, thank you.
For the record, I'm Vanya Sloan of the League of Women Voters of Ashland. I live at 816 Roca Street in Ashland. The League is a nonpartisan political organization which encourages the informed and active participation of citizens in government. We work to influence public policy through education and advocacy. The League has already testified and turned in testimony through this bill, and I'm here to endorse the testimony and to ask you to oppose 2583. The League believes it should be the policy of the state to encourage voting, not to construct roadblocks to the registration process. House Bill 2583 should not be enacted. Requiring a birth certificate, passport, or naturalization papers will create barriers for some groups of citizens trying to register. Many citizens do not have passports, and I know of no one who carries around a birth certificate. Young people in particular may simply decide not to bother. Certainly, voter registration drives will be affected at a time when we are trying to increase participation in democracy. The League believes that every citizen should be encouraged to register and that the process should be accessible, efficient, and simple. House Bill 2583 would make it less accessible and more complicated. This is the opposite of the result sought by HAVA, which attempts to make the whole process of elections more open and user-friendly, particularly for the disabled, minorities, and young children. For the above reasons, the League of Women Voters opposes House Bill 2583, and thank you for allowing me to testify on this issue.
Yeah, I thank you for your testimony. I just want one quick clarification.
Sure.
We're not, the bill does not seek to require people to carry around a passport or carry around a birth certificate, simply provide it upon, just as you do with the other aforementioned HAVA requirements, which I guess aren't really required.
Well, I would see where that could be a problem, though, for people just registering, because it may not be well known, or many people don't have birth certificates, or not birth certificates, but passports. It just would make an increased burden, and I personally believe that this body should be doing everything they can to encourage participation in democracy, and the emphasis should be on having more people vote, encouraging more voter participation, and not on limiting voter participation, which is what this would do.
Well, I respectfully would disagree with you, but I do appreciate your testimony. Thank you. Are there any other questions? Seeing none, thank you.
Thank you.
If you have a question or a comment for the committee, you got to come up and state it to the committee.
Lynn Horstemeyer, one of the other things that the DMV handbook shows as identification that is required for a driver's license, and which then, in essence, becomes your identification if you were going to register to vote, because it doesn't say anything about who can vote and who can't, is a matricular card.
Great. Thank you.
So,
good information. Would you like to testify on this bill?
I would like to, yes. I saw the precedent here. For some, I failed to sign out, but I would like to say. I'm sorry.
My name is Brenda Gould, and I do live and work in Medford.
Great.
I'm an immigration attorney, actually. So I wanted to throw in a couple comments regarding this. I see this has to do with how great a role the state of Oregon wants to take in enforcing federal law. That's part of what I see. What else I do see is that there is lots of federal law on this matter. There are various checks The ones familiar to me are in the Immigration and Nationality Act. Now, if a person comes to my office and wishes to become a permanent resident, one of the questions I've memorized over the years, it's just right there, it confronts the person right away, have you ever voted in an election? So that's you know, one of the 14 questions right there on the residency application. Have you ever done that? If you have done that, explain yourself, document it, you know, put it right out there. That's one of the things that you are swearing, you know, yes or no to when you do send out that residency application. It comes up on various immigration applications. For sure, it comes up at the time when you do want to become a U.S. citizen. If you would like to become a naturalized citizen of the United States, I'm not remembering if there are more than 14 questions. It's a 16-page application at this point in time if you want to become a naturalized citizen of the United States. And the question appears in similar language. Have you ever voted in an election in the United States? Now, in either case, whether you were applying for residency or if you were applying for U.S. citizenship, if you answer yes to that, well, you know, by and large, your application is going to be denied. That's one thing that is going to happen. That's not the only thing that's going to happen, but that's one thing that's going to happen. Ordinarily, the immigration attorney is going to, you know, the immigration attorney may say, you know, you really shouldn't be applying for this. There may be certain circumstances where it's still a reasonable thing to do to go ahead and apply and understand still what the repercussions may be. So other repercussions can be, well, supposing you're applying for residency and you have voted in an election. Well, then, that comes to the attention of the immigration examiner. Where does that leave you? You have your residency application denied, and you may be put into deportation or removal proceedings. So there are things to be done with you. That could be the end result of your naturalization application also, if you go ahead and file it. It could lead to your having your residency application, your residency status pulled, you know, and then the rest of the specter of things that can happen under immigration law. That's really all I wanted to raise just now. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much for coming forward and being on the record and participating.
Certainly appreciate it.
Great. Thank you. President Greenleaf has a final comment?
No, a question.
A question, I'm sorry.
How many times in your experience have people reported that they have voted in an election illegally?
Okay. Well, in my experience in coming to my office and, you know, filling out those applications I spoke of, I've not actually come across anyone who says that he or she has voted.
I am ready for the final comment.
Have any of those applicants that did not admit to voting ever been found to have voted, lying to you in the process?
That's not come across my desk. No. I have had people who have lied on those applications, but not on that matter.
That's my question.
That's right.
Thank you, Representative Thatcher.
Yeah, would there be any process to verify answers on this? I mean, how would you know if somebody was lying about that?
How would you know? That's right. Well, I know that county clerks such as Kathy Beckett do maintain records of who the registered voters are. I guess what you're asking me, Representative Thatcher, is, you know, how do we imagine that word would get out and eventually back to the immigration agent or typically several immigration agents who would be reviewing this application. And it seems to me if it were going to get back, I don't know, based on the way that other information gets back to those immigration officers, that gets a person into trouble, gets an applicant into trouble. It seems to be the kind of thing where a family member, some hostile family member or will be calling an immigration agent, another immigration agent, and just starting a process of complaining about an applicant, and, you know, that person really should be deported from the country, and these are the various reasons why that person should be deported from the country. And so while I've not had the situation here regarding that particular question, you know, that's, I have had that situation regarding other questions that come up on those applications.
Brenda, wouldn't an easy way to do that is those that are coming to you for naturalization status or coming into you and you're going through the questions and you simply ask them, have you voted? And they say, no. Wouldn't all you have to do is just take their name and run it through the county clerks and see if they were lying?
You're a lawyer. Why would you do that?
Wouldn't that be the catch? I mean, is there any? I guess my ultimate question is: there a cross reference between those that are applying for citizenship status and have to answer these 14 questions? Is there any kind of a cross referencing between those applying and that list of names with a county clerk to see if, in fact, those people are not lying?
I would imagine that immigration lawyers do that on occasion, and I certainly do that. With some of those 14 questions, I do my own checking. You know, anything that's a criminal red flag or an immigration red flag having to do with any prior immigration proceedings, those are things that I take the initiative. I go ahead and check out on my own in some way. Let me see. Oh, here's what comes up, though, in my client base, and I think for most immigration attorneys. And if it were as simple as just getting very familiar with Kathy Beckett's office, you know, perhaps we'd go that length respecting this voting question. But these clients of ours have lived in so many different counties in several different states. And so, you know, typically we don't pursue the investigation of that question.
Sure. Thank you. Appreciate your time.
You're certainly welcome. Thank you.
Representative Greenlee, final question or comment?
Comment, yes, Mr. Chair. Thank you. You've now taken us on a tour of the state, which has been a very enjoyable tour, in fact, and very informative for us. And we've heard 2583, I think, twice in Salem and now nine times or some number. I missed one of the hearings around the state. And I think the sponsors of this bill worry properly about a good elections system, but I would like to point out that I don't think there has been a single instance in our testimony that's provided evidence of a widespread attempt of illegals to vote, nor, in fact, has there even been a suggestion of a single known specific Jose Martinez, my next-door neighbor, votes all the time, and he shouldn't. And I think it is good to put this on the record because while we need to protect against problems, we need to remember that we need to protect. There's a balance on the other side of that protection, and it has been interesting to hear folks around the state talk about this without ever coming forward with any specific concern. It's always been the general concern. We must protect our voices, which, of course, we all agree with. That's why we're here. Thank you, sir.
Thank you. Seeing nothing further. No. No. That's not what we're doing. It's an official committee meeting with a specific protocol. So, sorry. Representative Escobar.
On this issue, I think the thing that sitting here listening to people, we do not have a checks and balance in place. That's what my conclusion is. A driver's license? What's a driver's license? Anyone can get one with a heating bill. That's what gives you status and a right to vote. I am concerned about some of these issues. Now, whether, and the one thing I probably should have asked my fellow Medfordite, Kathy Beckett, is how do we know that there isn't fraud? That's the real question here, I think. Do we know for sure that we have a system in place that does not have fraud in it? I don't think anyone around this table can say yes. Maybe you can. I don't think so. But the one thing I pulled out of this, just listening, we do have some holes in the system. So.
Thank you. Seeing no further discussion on House Bill 2583, I will not read into the record as we did yesterday, but for the record, the note or the letter from the authors of this bill will be submitted into this testimony as well, as requested by the drafters of the bill. I just would like to extend it again, as I've already indulged them once before. We'll be closing the public hearing on House Bill 2583. This time we're going to open up a hearing on House Bill 2551, submitting the written testimony of Kate Culberson and Kathy Beckett for the record, and closing a public hearing on House Bill 2551. Colleagues, anything for the good of the order? Other than your participation in the process, I thank you. This concludes our statewide tour of rules and elections in the wonderful city of Medford. So thank you for being here, and thank you, guest members of the committee. With that, adjourned.